Oh, I really do hate it when people tell folks I'm a preaching coach. It sets the bar so high. And I have a line that I do tell my clients about their sermons. That every church, a third of the people are going to love your sermon. A third of the people are not going to love your sermon. And a third don't care anyway. But you called me because none of those people know what they're talking about. So we're going to try and get our thirds a little bit more balanced over our course of time together. But I did want to say thank you for your response to what many of our neighbors and friends have been experiencing in Houston and in Central Texas. Houston is the biggest small town in the world. And so just about everyone I know has someone who was affected by the floods last week. And I have this clear memory of last Sunday morning, one of our wonderful community members gets up to share the invocation with the church. And she talks about her time as a camper at Camp Mystic as a teenage girl. And another at another campus talks about how God transformed her life at camp. And my wife gets a text from one of her co-teachers talking about how she discovered Jesus at Camp Mystic. And so it is a profound tragedy for many of us in and around our city. And I just want to thank you for your role in that. We're going to open the scriptures together. Before we do that, let me ask God's blessing on our time. Creator God, we are grateful that you love us and that you have redeemed us. And that you invite us into this redemptive relationship with you where we can step every day more fully into who you are and what you are doing. And God, can we see this morning how you are inviting us to something new and beautiful, regardless of how we arrived this morning? And toward that end, Lord, I pray that you pour through me the gift of preaching, that everything said here be from you and because of you and guiding us toward you, Lord, as we partner with you to bring about your preferred future for all of creation. And we ask it in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, we're going to spend a little bit of time in John 12. But before we do that, I'm going to talk to you about some of my favorite things, which are movies. But I'm going to talk to you about a movie that's not a really great movie that some of you may have seen. It's called The Age of Adeline. And this movie came out several years ago. And Adeline was the first baby born in San Francisco on January 1st in 1908. And she has a normal life. She grows up. She gets married. She has a daughter. And then she is widowed in 1937 when her husband is killed in a construction accident in the building of the Golden Gate Bridge. So 10 months after her husband passes, Adeline is driving in Northern California on a dark, rainy night, rain coming down sideways. She slides off the road into a ravine that is full of water, and she dies. But the moment she dies, there is a lightning strike from the skies. It hits the water and revives her, brings her back to life. I told you, it's not a great movie. But from that moment, Adeline never gets older. She never wrinkles. She never ages. She stays 29 for the rest of her story. Now, I know a lot of us really like the idea of staying 29 forever. Like, that's why we do all the stuff that we do while we work out and the wrinkle creams and the facelifts and all the stuff that people do. But it actually becomes a problem because while she's not growing any older, everybody else that she knows and loves is, even her daughter. And so they all get older and die, and she doesn't. But there's another problem. As she doesn't know why this is happening to her, and she can't explain it, and she doesn't want anyone else to try to explain it either, and eventually someone's going to ask, why aren't you getting any older? And so Adeline decides to spend her life traveling around the world, learning languages and new cultures, studying things of interest. And every time she travels, she changes her name, she reinvents herself, reinvents her life. And that's what she does until she meets a man named Ellis. And Ellis is one of those guys who comes into the picture of a movie and he's tall and good looking and rich. And I was like, I would date this guy. And so they fall in love. But when Adeline meets Ellis, she tells him that her name is Jenny. And that's how he knows her. And so they do all the stuff that happens in movies where movie directors are trying to signal to you that these people have fallen in love and care about one another. And Ellis decides that it's time now for Jenny to meet his family. So he invites her to their weekend house to meet his parents. And as soon as Ellis and Jenny walk into the house, Ellis's dad, standing at the end of the hallway, played by Harrison Ford, turns around, he looks at Jenny and says, "Adeline." Well, she explains that the person that he remembers as Adeline was actually her mother and that she died several years ago. But he's puzzled by this. It's just too, they look too much alike. And so he goes back digging through all the pictures because turns out 40 years ago, Ellis's dad had met Adeline overseas, and they had fallen in love. And he had planned to ask her to marry him, but when she found out, because he could not know her secret, she left and left him brokenhearted. So finally, there's a scene when Ellis's dad confronts Adeline about who she really is. She confesses that she is the Adeline that he remembers. None of them can explain what's happening. She now knows that she can't stay with Ellis, that she's got to go. So she writes him a note and races downstairs, gets in the car, and leaves. And a little while after that, Ellis comes back home, and he's asking his dad, "Where's Jenny?" And he said, "She left you a note." Ellis reads the note, doesn't quite understand. He grabs his keys. He's going to go chase after Jenny. And Ellis's dad looks at him and he says, "Son, stop. She can't." She can't what? She can't change. And the reason that Adeline can't change is because Adeline can't die. Adeline can't change and she can't die, but it also means that she can't ever be known and she can't ever be loved. And just because I love to lighten the mood, I want to spend a little bit of time thinking together about how people change. And have you ever considered the possibility that your ability to die creates your ability to change, to grow, to connect? Because without that ability to die, both literally and figuratively, we all become like Adeline. We cannot be known and we cannot be loved. Like Steve said, I have two daughters. The oldest was with me the last time I was here. She was about to head off to college for the first time. Now she is a senior. She will be a senior at the University of Texas starting here in a couple of weeks, which means that we are 41 days away from college football. And our youngest will be a freshman at Abilene Christian University in Abilene, Texas, where I went and my wife went and so many of our friends and my mother and father-in-law went. She'll be third generation there. And because of a lot of things happening in our own personal lives, we have been thinking and talking about death and things related to death and about living quite a bit in the last couple of years. So just this last month, I celebrated my 51st birthday. I know, this is when you say, "Sean, you are far too young and good-looking to be 51. And God just gives you what he gives you. But for so many reasons, Rochelle, my wife and I have been surrounded by death and talk of death and dying a lot over the last few years. We were watching a movie not too long ago, one of our favorites from when we were teenagers, and I said, do you realize that every actor in this movie is now dead? And our moms call us, and they give us reports of Bible class teachers and school teachers, people that we knew growing up, that we admired and loved, who are dead or dying. And then there are other deaths that come to us too. For years, I was a runner until 4 years ago when I was diagnosed with pretty severe arthritis in both my feet. And I've always had a knee condition that only got worse, so I don't run anymore. I do what all 51-year-olds do for exercise now, pickleball. Which I took in college in 1995. I'm not new to the game. And I know, like, the trail, what's ahead only gets worse for us. For years, I would speak every Thursday morning at a geriatric care clinic. And it was all of these people in their latter and waning years, and they would come in and sit in chairs and say the Pledge of Allegiance, and they would do little exercises in their chair, and they had little games they'd play with manipulatables. It was very much like kindergarten. And I thought, is this what happens? Because I'd look in the eyes of those women and men and know that every one of them at some point in their life was vibrant and active, that they did things with their life that mattered, not just to them, but mattered to other people. And life is a series of deaths, big deaths and small deaths. One of my favorite theologians says that life is a series of surrenders. And maybe a helpful way to think about it is to think about all the people that you've ever loved. And in the process of loving those people, you've had to surrender something. When you fell in love with your partner, well, they deserve to know where you are and what you're doing and how you're spending the money. Or when you have children, that there's even more of your life to surrender. Remember when people told you, when you first had children, like they told me, you will never sleep the same way again. And then our bodies surrender to the ravages of time, and in the end, we face the final surrender. And the question is not whether life will or will not give you opportunities for surrender. The question is how we will receive them, and whether or not we will see and discover anything redemptive about surrender. So in the Christian tradition, one of the ways that many contemplative Christians have talked about the rhythm of surrender is what they call the Paschal Mystery. And Ronald Rollheiser writes about the Paschal Mystery. He's the one who introduced me to it, and he says, the Paschal Mystery is a process of transformation within which we are given both new life and new spirit. It begins with suffering and death, moves on to the reception of new life, spends some time grieving the old and adjusting to the new, and finally, only after the old life has been truly let go of, is new spirit given for the life we are already leading. And so what Rollheiser is saying is there's this pattern for all of life, and since I didn't grow up in churches that had very much of a liturgical calendar or paid very much attention to the Christian calendar, I totally missed it. And it's possible that in my missing it, that I miss the actual rhythm of how life is lived. And so there are these stages, and there are stages for everyone and all of us right now, regardless of how we arrived, regardless of our accomplishments. Today, we are experiencing this in our real lives. And Rollheiser says that the Paschal Mystery works like this. He says it begins with Good Friday, which is the loss of life, a real death. and you don't have to live very long to experience a real death. Maybe the death of a hope or a dream or a plan, the death of a relationship. Even those transitions that all of us go through, maybe just from middle school to high school, it's a death. Moving to a new city with new friends, the loss of the old. And then Rollheiser says that moves to us to Easter Sunday, which is the reception of new life, that there is a new reality that we are stepping into. And then the 40 days, it's a time for readjustment to the new and for grieving the old. And this is so critical because we are in a culture that really hates to grieve. And oftentimes when we are in the middle of grief, someone will tell us that we shouldn't grieve, or they will signal to us that they would be much more comfortable if we just got through the grieving faster. There are real griefs in life. And then there's ascension, the letting go of the old, and the refusal to cling. And you've been around people who could not let go, who had to cling. And that leads us to Pentecost, which is the reception of a new spirit for the new life that we're already living. And we are all in this journey somewhere. And the reality is that in different arenas of your life, you can be in different places of that journey. That things at home and with your family, that you may be in a season of new life, but things at work or with your parents, well, you may be grieving. Because it's part of surrender. So like I said, the last time I was here, it was 3 years ago, and my oldest daughter was headed off to college for the first time. And all of us who have sent children off to college know how emotionally mixed that is. But about 4 weeks before our oldest daughter, Malia, was born, my wife got a phone call from her doctor. And the doctor said, I don't think you're ever going to be able to have children. And so for 5 years after we got married, we did all of the things that people do who want to have children and have some hurdles around conceiving a child. And literally one day out of the blue, her doctor called and said, you remember those tests last week? You're pregnant. I was off at a church elders meeting. I came home. It was a late Tuesday night. She says this to me as we're standing in the kitchen, and I say, you're pregnant? Is it mine? Like, that's... But for us, Malia has always been our miracle child. And because of our ministry journey, we've never lived that close to our parents or extended family. And so much of our lives together has just been the four of us. To the point now that sometimes our girls don't want grandma to come for Christmas because we have 21 years of rituals and traditions that are just us. And so when Malia was leaving, like, that was a time of grief. It wasn't bereavement. No one had died, but it was the reality that our lives were suddenly going to have to change, and we had no idea what it was going to look like in the future. And so she went off to school. She reminds me that, Dad, I went to the cheapest and closest place that we could find. But that next year, after we dropped her off in August, you know, she'd come home for trips. I was in Austin, where she's in school, speaking at an event. And so I called her the week before. Malia, I'm going to be in Austin. You got time to see me? No. And she was doing a service project that day and had some other events with friends. And she said, but I can meet you for dinner. I have this clear memory of seeing her walk in the room at this event. And she was so confident and so strong and so beautiful. And she's always been responsible and smart and a good student and all of those things. But at that moment, I realized, this is not the child that I dropped off here. And that would have never have happened had we tried to cling to an old life and not envision a new life, both for her and for us. And you've seen people, you have seen other folks in your world who have tried to cling to one thing or another, cling to a relationship that was well over, cling to their children, cling to a job. Every one of us has been in a situation where someone has said, but we've always done it this way. It's clinging. And so while I was reading about the Paschal Mystery, I was also reading Bono's book, Surrender. And Bono is the lead singer of U2. And he just tells 40 stories of 40 songs, how they were written, what was going on in his life. And there's one that stood out to me, a song that I didn't know. I'm not like a huge U2 fan, but my friend Aaron Nequist told me that I really needed to read it. And he talks about his friendship with Michael Hutchence. And Michael Hutchence was the lead singer for NXS. And Bono and his wife, Allie, and Michael's partner, Helena, had been friends for years until they had a falling out. And Bono says that he and Allie were very judgmental about their relationship and lots of other things happening. And so they didn't talk for years until Michael was going through a really tough separation from Helena. And she wouldn't let him see their kids. He was struggling with abuse issues. And it got so bad that one Sunday morning, while Michael was on tour in Australia, he died by suicide. And so Bono responds to this the way that he responds to a lot of things. He writes a song about it, and he says the song is not kind, it's not gentle, but it's where I was at the moment. It was what I was thinking at the moment. And it's called Stuck in a Moment You Can't Get Out Of. And this are part of the lyrics. Bono writes, you've got to get yourself together. You got stuck in a moment and now you can't get out of it. Don't say that later will be better. Now you're stuck in a moment and you can't get out of it. And I think Bono is warning us of the same thing that the Paschal Mystery is trying to teach us, that unless we learn to step into the rhythms of surrender, our choices are either to surrender or get stuck. And my family and Bono are just snapshots of something that's way more profound and something that happens to everyone, to learn to surrender in the midst of all of the ups and downs, the joys and grievances of actual life. So John 12, I told you we'd get back there, paints these four portraits in rapid succession of Jesus' life. And the first one, Mary anoints Jesus' feet. This is a signal that Jesus is the anointed one, that he is the right and only truthful king. For Jesus, for the disciples, that is an up moment that someone has declared who Jesus really is. The very next story is the plot to kill Lazarus. Lazarus, Jesus' friends, we have gone from up to down. And then the next story after that is Jesus' triumphal entry, where all of these people are coming down, laying down palm branches, where you actually get the name Palmer, for those of you checking into it, declaring that Jesus is the Lord. And then we get this story starting in verse 20. Among the crowds traveling to Jerusalem were Greeks seeking to follow God and worship at the great feast. Some of them came to Philip with an important request. "Sir, we are hoping to meet Jesus." Philip, a disciple from the Galilean village of Bethsaida, told Andrew that these Greeks wanted to see Jesus. Together, Andrew and Philip reproached Jesus to inform him about the request. Jesus says, "The time has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. I tell you the truth, unless a grain of wheat is planted in the ground and dies, it remains a solitary seed. But when it is planted, it produces in death a great harvest. The one who loves this life will lose it, and the one who despises it in this world will have life forevermore. Anyone who serves me must follow my path. Anyone who serves me will want to be where I am, and he will be honored by the Father. My spirit is low and unsettled. How can I ask the Father to save me from this hour? This hour is the purpose for which I have come into the world. But what I can say is this: Father, glorify your name." Christ Church, this is what I'd want you to hear. For people, for families, for churches to grow, develop, deepen, to do anything meaningful, we have to do what we don't want to do. We have to learn to surrender. We have to die to the gifts that God has given us in the past so that God can give us new gifts for a new life. Jesus is saying that in order for him to be glorified, then he must die. But in that there is much, much fruit. The seed has to die to produce fruit. So I told you that last month was my 51st birthday. And birthdays have always been complicated in my family. My birthday is June 15th. I have an older brother whose birthday is June 18th. And what makes them complicated is that my dad was cheap and he only wanted to throw one birthday party. And one of the reasons that I've been thinking about death a lot is that coming up at the end of the month, we will commemorate as a family the death of my brother. He died 2 years ago, and my family was on vacation in Southern California when I was awoken very early in the morning for a phone call from my mom screaming through the receiver saying, "Richard is gone." And he was 52. And this was sudden and a shock. And I have clear memories of being at his funeral, because he and my sister-in-law married later in life. They chose not to have any children. But what they also chose to do was to pour into tons and tons of children in their church and their friends' kids. And I heard for over an hour stories that I did not know about the ways that he had blessed them and walked with them. And it was very reminiscent of the same person he was when he was 18, because there was something about his orientation to the world that always felt like the best life that he could live would be a life lived for other people. And it's so much so that the church where he worships created a service award after his death in his name that they give to key volunteers every year and throw a huge party. And I would love to still have my brother, but I see in his death so much fruit. And it doesn't always need to be a physical death. But what Jesus is saying is for God to do the next beautiful and powerful thing in your life, some parts of who you are today must die. And we will want to cling. For many of us, what needs to die might be an old way of relating to a partner or a spouse or a parent or a child. And then others of us, it's the idea that you should and you could still have the same body that you had 10 years ago. And maybe for you, it's the belief or the thought about yourself that someone handed you years and years ago and you still hold on to and cling to. Maybe it's the death of your youth. Maybe it's the death of an outdated dream. You're just never gonna play for the Cubs. All of us resist our surrenders. But what if in that resistance we are also resisting the grand thing that God wants to do next for us? The option is to cling or surrender. And what if your greatest defense against the next move of God in your life is you clinging to the last move of God in your life? Unless a seed falls to the ground, it cannot produce fruit. So here are just a few ways to wrap your arms around that. You have to start by naming your deaths. The parts of your life that really have passed away, that are passing away, and to own those earnestly and honestly. But then after you name all of those deaths, you have to claim your birth. Where's the good and the true and the beautiful that God is bringing into your life? Where are the places God is inviting you to step into newness? But then you also have to grieve what is lost and adjust to a new reality. And never fall for the lie that grieving what mattered to you is wrong or bad or faithless. If something matters, let it matter. And do not cling to the old. As Jesus told Mary after the tomb on Easter morning, do not cling to me. The Lord is doing something new. Let it ascend. Let it give you a blessing. And then accept the spirit of the life you're already living. And as we walk through this together and help one another walk through it, we will discover that God is always doing the next beautiful thing. And you right now, right where you are, wherever in the mystery, are invited to join God. Let me pray for you. Creator God, help us see the places that you are inviting us to newness and help us name the places where we need to grieve. And we know without your spirit, we are incapable of all of us. So would you give us strength and newness and vitality? Give us eyes to see and ears to hear. In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.